Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And welcome back to the podcast, my hoes. Welcome back to War Crimes, which, yes, I know that we already technically have done War Crimes in a previous episode. If you went back and actually listened to that, we covered the history of the Geneva Conventions and their role in determining war crimes. Now, most people, I'll say this here from the very beginning, especially history buffs, they are very well versed in the basics of war crimes and big wars, like when it comes to World War I and World War II. You know, the basic stuff when you like first get into history, and also, of course, the stuff going into a lot of the modern day warfare aspect. This includes some of the basic recognized war crimes, such as, you know, not targeting civilians, not executing surrendering soldiers, and helping out the wounded, regardless of which side they're actually on. And honestly, when we're going to go into this here today, I think it's fair to say that we are all universally in agreement that these are very heinous offenses. These are things that should not be done, and that is why the Geneva Conventions were created. But today, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be covering the weirder war crimes. And by weird, I mean war crimes that, technically speaking, they exist, and they range from the unusual to just shocking things. This includes how even big industries like Hollywood and the gaming industry have also actually been tangled up in this kind of mess. So join us today as we go and peel back the layers of history to reveal the lesser known, yet at the same time, still not insignificant chapters of human conflict that are weird war crimes.
And everyone, before we continue, I just wanted to remind you that we only have one early bird spot that gives you a $200 discount for Germany. In addition, we only have four total spots for our trip to Peru in July. So if you guys would like to join us on either of these trips, make sure to check them out. The link will be in the description below. We'd love to see you there.
Spots are definitely going fast. And also, before we get into this, I would like to thank the member of our Discord, Chisholm, who is one of our researchers and writers who has helped to produce this episode. So for those of you who had missed the War Crimes episode that we did on the History of Everything podcast, here's a bit of a quick rundown of exactly how things went, like the history of war crimes and how actions are actually considered to be war crimes. So again, a little bit of a refresher. There are two basic avenues for how you can determine the, well, actions of a particular soldier or military as war crimes, right? The Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions. Today, there are four Geneva Conventions and three protocols. The creation of these dates all the way back to the mid-1800s, and what is currently recognized as the first Geneva Convention, which is on the wounded and sick in armed forces in the battlefield, that was created and adopted by 12 states in 1864. There were then subsequent revisions in 1906 and 1929. The 1929 convention, which is now known as the Third Geneva Convention, that would have been on the treatment of prisoners of war, which was also created and adopted at that time. But then, of course, this didn't stop from horrible, horrible things happening over the course of World War II. And so when you fast forward to 1949, after World War II, this is when the Geneva Conventions, as we know them today, were revised and fully adopted, so to speak. In 1949, both the first and third conventions would receive their final revisions for adoption by the international community. The second Geneva Convention, that one that was concerning the wounded, sick, and shipwrecked members of the armed forces at sea, would be adopted in 1949, and this was a successor of the Hague Convention of 1907. The fourth Geneva Convention, that being the one that would protect civilians during times of war, well, that was adopted based on the parts of the Hague Conventions of 1899 and 1907. Collectively, these four conventions are just referred to commonly as the Geneva Conventions of 1949, or just the Geneva Conventions.
I did not know it was four different conventions.
Yes, and so that's what it is that we had been going into, because when people talk about, oh, the Geneva Conventions, they think post-World War II. No, people had been trying to stop war, or at least limit its effects for the longest time. Like, oh, Gab, one of the hilarious little details is, did you know that the inventor of the machine gun, like, well, I say this, like the invention of the Gatling gun, like one of the first ever machine guns, so to speak, even though it was a crank, like a hand crank gun, that was invented by a guy, a doctor, who specifically wanted to make warfare, and I quote, so horrific that nations would no longer fight wars because it would be too awful.
Did he really think that would work?
Yes. He thought that he was basically creating a deterrent that no one would utilize armies to attack each other because they could just be wiped out.
But that doesn't make any sense, because back in the day, the crossbow was like one of the most horrific weapons you could use on someone, and it didn't stop anyone. It made people go, oh, maybe we shouldn't use it, but it didn't stop them.
Correct, and they did try to limit it, but this is also talking about something on a level of scale where it's like, I still remember the intro. Do you remember how I would show you Shogun 2, Fall of the Samurai?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so that is still, to this day, one of my favorite games of all time. And when the trailer would come out, the iconic image of the U.S. armed military personnel who's trying to sell the Japanese a Gatling gun, and it's just this showman who's talking, and it's like, invented by the Dr. Richard A. Gatling, this one device can do the work of 40 riflemen. And it's just like basically selling it to the Japanese who's watching it mow down a bunch of samurai. It's great.
I do not remember that, but it sounds horrific.
Oh, it was. It absolutely was. And that's really one of the defining things, is people always had been trying to limit warfare. They just were not necessarily very successful for most of that time. So, okay, since 1949, three additional protocols have been added to the Geneva Conventions. Beginning in 1977, the first two major revisions were Protocol 1 of the Protection of Victims of International Armed Conflict and Protocol 2 on the Protection of Victims of Non-International Armed Conflict. In 2005, there was the most recent addition, which was Protocol 3, which I'm going to be talking about more here in a minute. The Geneva Convention primarily focuses on the protection of war victims and participants, whereas the Hague Conventions are focused on the means and methods of warfare, as well as the conduct of hostilities and occupation. So basically, when you're actually fighting and what can be done during it. The Hague Conventions are a result of three international conferences in 1899, 1907, and 1954. The first two conferences resulted in the creation of 11 treaties, each of which would focus on a specific aspect of the manner and methods in which war was to be conducted, and the third Hague Conference in 1954 would add the protection of cultural property into the mix. Some aspects of the Hague Convention have been adopted into other international laws, but these are the big ones.
So cultural protections would be temples and landmarks?
Yeah, you literally couldn't attack. Okay, so I'll give you this as an example. This is one of the most horrifying things that has really happened. You know how in varying different things where the Islamic State has taken over regions in the Middle East, like as an example, Lebanon and parts in Syria have some of the oldest and had some of the best preserved Roman ruins in the world outside of like Rome itself. Do you know what they did after taking over the area?
What?
They blew them the hell up.
Why?
Because foreign pagans bad. We need to destroy history. Like, that was literally their stance on it, was that they wanted to remove it. It's like the equivalent of what would happen if, like, let's say some hardline Baptist group came in and didn't like that people were teaching anything on evolution, so they destroyed any records of dinosaurs. Like, that's what it is that we're talking about for cultural significance. It's absolutely terrible. So these are things that would all be added into that time, and it was one of the key aspects that would need to be protected as time went on. So this is going to create this weird little thing of warfare rules, which, well, can be violated in some ways. The question that we're talking about today, though, is the weird ones, right? To start this off, this is the one that I think is arguably the most talked about when it comes to things on the internet, and that is the Stardew Valley incident. Okay, Gabby, are you familiar with this at all?
No.
Okay. You know the game Stardew Valley? Because like it's like the farming sim game that is on the...
Yeah, the game that I hate because the fishing is really difficult.
Oh, yeah, I remember. I remember that because at the time, I still remember you really tried to get into Stardew Valley and also into... Why am I drawing a blank on it? It's like Animal Crossing.
I don't like games with no objective.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's objectives, but I don't like relaxed games. I need the high adrenaline with a goal.
For anyone who is curious, her favorite game is Uncharted. Not your favorite game, but one of it.
My favorite game is Destiny.
Yes. Okay. To be fair. So, okay, the Stardew incident. Let's go ahead and get into this, right? This is arguably, as I said, one of the most famous weird war crimes of them all. That time where the Stardew Valley developers ended up inadvertently, accidentally committing a war crime. Which sounds so incredibly dumb. Yes, the farming game that made a lot of media attention because it actually violated international law.
Here's the thing. I thought private people, like non-government agencies, non-military agencies could not commit, like they couldn't break the Geneva Conventions.
See, you would think about that. Yes, yes. So, in most cases.
It doesn't apply to private citizens?
It can when certain aspects and things are being done. Like as an example, like let's say that you are a non-combatant, right? And you are in a war zone. You're just in one of these kinds of scenarios, right? And let's say that you do something like, oh, you pick up a rock and you throw it at someone. Like with the intention, like you were trying to harm, like you specifically performed a violent action in there. Even if you are a civilian, you at that point are no longer considered just a non-combatant. You have specifically taken up arms to actually fight. Like that's a thing. There's a difference, of course, with trying to actually defend yourself if someone is attacking you and trying to get away versus you've actually gone out of your way to attack someone. The other is blatant use or misrepresentation of something that is going on with the military. And that is actually where this goes on, right? It's a bit of a joke because this is one of the only cases that we've actually been able to find of something like this. Because on November 19th, 2018, the Stardew Valley dev team would release a patch, version 1.3.32. And within this patch, there was a very unusual change note. Like, you know how when they do an update and they list all the varying different things that they change? One of these lines in the code or in the statement said, quote, fixed a Geneva Convention violation. Now, okay, this is definitely not a normal thing that would be included in a patch, let alone actually listed as being a bug fix. So you may be wondering, this is a private company of a digital world, of a farming simulator. What possible Geneva violation did they enact, you might be wondering? Well, simply put, they used the Red Cross.
Really?
Yes. For anyone who is curious about this, on one of their buildings, which was Harvey's Clinic, the developers had placed a Red Cross above the doorway, the thing that you actually commonly associate as being part of, like, you know, a medic.
Why was that an issue? Because it's a game. Obviously, no one's like, hey, that's the Red Cross.
Yeah, see, that's what you would think. In doing this, the game was in direct violation of the Geneva Convention over something that really does seem quite mundane. See, Article 44 of the first Geneva Convention protects the emblems of the Red Cross and associated societies, namely the Red Crescent and the Red Lion Sun, which are things that almost no one in the Western world is actually really aware of outside of people that perhaps are in the military and may actually have to interact with these. The Red Lion and Sun were previously only used by Iran from 1924 to 1980, because go figure. When the Red Cross is technically speaking a Christian symbol. So it is something that even though people do associate it with medics, simultaneously, it is not something that would be used by a number of different Islamic societies. So to this day, Iran maintains their right to use the Red Lion and Sun. And considering what has been going on with current events, like with Iran and everything else here, who knows? Maybe we're actually going to end up seeing that again. Possibly. I don't know. In 2005, Protocol 3 at the Geneva Convention was signed, and Article 2 would reaffirm the recognition of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent. And actually, weirdly enough, for the first time, it would recognize the Red Crystal, which was a religion-neutral icon. Because yes, Christianity and Islam are the two biggest religions in the world, but simultaneously, that doesn't apply to everyone.
Okay, I never made the connection that the Red Cross and the Red Crescent, like the sun, those were religious.
Yeah, because to be fair, when you look at the Red Cross, like we say cross, but it really is more like a plus sign. It's not a cross where the lower line is bigger than the others. You know, like an actual standing cross or anything like that.
Yeah, like how the leg of the cross would be longer than the arms.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that is something that from even when I was a kid, I didn't really realize that they were it was an actual symbol of a cross until going into a much later time when actually going back and studying this.
Hello, my friends. Takuya here. And before we get back to the show, I would like to thank today's sponsor, Factor. For those of you who are not familiar with Factor and their never frozen meals, I have to say this is something that definitely helped me back when my house was being worked on this previous January, because for essentially 3 months, we didn't have a kitchen, which meant that Factor really did save our lives because we got this box in the mail that had all these fresh, never frozen meals that could be warmed up in simply like 2 minutes, and that's it. It was super easy to do, and since we didn't have an actual kitchen, just a microwave, this was a life changer for us. Every single meal was customized for what it is that we wanted. There were keto options, there were vegetarian options, there were many, many different forms. And this is something that is perfect for each and every person who can craft exactly what it is that they want. So I'm telling you this right now, if you want to make things easier for yourself this spring, then go to factormeals.com/historyofeverything50 and use code historyofeverything50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. It is just that easy, and I guarantee this is something that can help a lot of people. Hey everyone, Sakuya here, and before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure that your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So the thing about this is that using the symbol creates a bit of a conflict. Red Cross volunteers, buildings, temporary structures and vehicles, these may always use protected symbols on uniforms and displayed on the top of vehicles and structures. And members of the armed forces may always use these markings, and civilian institutions like hospitals can use them during times of war. There are a few exceptions, of course, but these must be approved by the International Committee of the Red Cross. You can't just have a private company utilizing this symbol because it is an actual symbol of an organization in war, like in conflict.
Okay, so, I mean, one, it's disrespectful. Two, it's confusing. People won't know the significance of it.
That's part of it. Actually, yes. So it goes back to an idea of kind of cheapening the symbol, so to speak, of people not really processing what it is that it actually means. The Red Cross cares about the symbol no matter where it is used, whether that is in video games or other things. But I mean, in this case, they didn't actually sue them or anything like that, but it was something that had been brought to the developers' attention, to their attention. So the International Committee of the Red Cross had put out a statement explaining that, quote, the misuse of this valued symbol distorts its meaning and its protective value for victims of the conflict and the aid workers that assist them. When someone misuses the Red Cross, we seek their cooperation in ending the unauthorized use. In nearly all cases, they comply and no further action is necessary. The basic idea, the concern, is that if you allow anyone, private citizens, businesses, etc., to use protected symbols, then their actions are going to reinforce the idea that these symbols are in the public domain and just available to use. That is something that weakens their protective value as icons of protection for religious and medical personnel and the 16 million volunteers the Red Cross and Red Crescent Moon movement have around the world.
In movies, are they allowed to be used in movies if it's like a war movie or historical retelling?
Well, think about this. Let's say that they're showing something specifically from Vietnam, and it's that kind of thing where you would have, or in World War II, where you'd have a medic, right? And a medic is going in, they have a Red Cross symbol or somewhere on their body, and they are going through and they are grabbing wounded. Medics were not allowed to carry weapons into battle, typically. So the reason being is because they didn't have weapons. They were considered non-combatant medical personnel that were trying to save lives. And they were obligated in many cases to save anyone's life, whether enemy or friendly. Like, that's what they were supposed to do. The action of shooting a medic was specifically a war crime. And so here's what would end up happening. The Japanese did this a lot back in World War II. They specifically aimed for medics. Not only did they specifically aim for medics, they would essentially use traps to try and draw them out. When shooting at a soldier, they would aim for a part of their body that was not likely to kill them. There were many cases where they would shoot someone in the leg and not continue firing at them to wait for the medic to go out and try and save them. And after the medic would come out to try and save them, they would shoot the medic.
But at that time, was it a war crime?
Yes.
Oh. Well, you know, but in movies, my original question was in movies.
Would they be when allowed? They're using it?
Yeah.
So they're specifically using it in the context of specifically the medics and workers that they're talking about, not from something that is in a game or otherwise that is not used in the context of war.
Okay.
So like, let's say that you were in a scenario and it's like, I don't know, it's Grand Theft Auto. You're playing that, right? Which that game is a war crime simulator in and of itself for anything and everything. But let's say that you have people that are running around there, you know, blowing things up while having Red Cross uniforms on. That is something that is a misuse of the symbol. It's a joke that they may be pulling in there, but that specifically is something that they're doing that is wrong.
Makes sense.
So, yeah, that is kind of the issue. The big thing is, like, they are very protective of this symbol. So if you think that Disney and Nintendo are hardcore in protecting their brands, the Red Cross is on a whole other level. Which brings us to the question of, okay, would Stardew Valley have actually been hauled to The Hague and faced charges for this? Well, probably not. It is pretty safe to say that the Red Cross has way more lawyers and way deeper pockets and more influence than Stardew Valley does. So turning the cross on Harvey's clinic from red to blue, well, that is something that saved everyone a lot of time, energy, money, and a lot of trouble. And that's precisely what they did.
How do they even track down all of the companies that use Red Crosses? Like, do they have people specifically on the lookout? Like, is there a number that you can call to report a Red Cross misuse?
I'm sure there is. There's got to be something with the Red Cross that specifically you can make a report of something. There has to be. I really don't know. The Red Cross is an organization that by its own charter is something that takes no sides in conflict. It doesn't provide any aid to participants in a given conflict or disaster. It doesn't do anything. And considering that the whole thing is Swiss in origin, you know, that neutrality really did something that makes sense. And also, it's kind of funny, I guess, from that logic that the Red Cross is a Red Cross. And do you know what the Swiss flag was?
A Red Cross?
It was a white cross on a red background.
Huh.
It's like they just reversed it specifically for the Red Cross.
I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, exactly. So, why is this then part of the Geneva Convention? Why is this something that is so important? Well, there have been many times in history that Red Cross workers have been prevented from leaving certain areas so that their aid, which they would provide aid to anyone, would only be provided to one side and not the other. To stop this from happening, the prevention of the Red Cross or other impartial humanitarian workers from protecting or providing aid to the sick and wounded, this is something that has also been made part of the Geneva Convention. And wait, did you say that you found something?
Yeah, if you want to report the misuse of the Red Cross emblem, you just email them at trademarks@redcross.org.
They have a dedicated email for it.
You can find that on their website because they explain the significance of their emblem and why they won't allow its use, like its misuse. It's pretty interesting. You can look it up on their website.
That makes way too much sense then. Okay, yeah, because that does explain then as to why they would actually be able to reach out and take care of these things. Okay, well, Another one here, interestingly enough, it also has to do with coloration and symbolism. Just as you cannot use the Red Cross iconography, the Geneva Convention also prevents the use of emblems and colors that are associated with neutral parties. This includes anyone from like a neutral nation. Like, you can't go into a scenario raising another nation's flag and then switch it over in order to start attacking someone. Like, you can't really do that. And so that really applies to anything, whether you're talking about the uniforms or specific colored headgear or anything. And yes, Gabby, there is a specific color of headgear that cannot be worn by any nation's military. And you've probably seen a number of these things when looking at any kind of the intervention photos that you'd see in any kind of conflict, especially going into the modern day. You know what color that is?
No.
Light blue.
You can't wear a light blue hat.
Nope. No, you cannot. It is a shade that is so specific and recognizable, you don't even have to see like what it is that I'm talking about to know what it is that I'm talking about, or the organization. Like, we're talking the UN. You know those very distinctive helmets that they have? It looks different in comparison to literally what anyone else would ever kind of wear. Like, just look it up, like, when you're talking about UN aid workers. Not like aid workers, but like UN security forces.
I'm going to be straight with you. I have never seen those hats in my life.
Okay, those hats helmets. The helmets, the headgear, anything that they would be wearing are incredibly iconic. And it's to a point that they're not going to be able to hide, right? Like, you think, oh, a helmet, that's going to protect your head, but also camouflage when you try to keep your head down. No, the entire point of the UN helmet is that it is seen. It needs to be seen. They are peacekeepers. That's what's supposed to happen.
How do they keep the peace?
Okay, there's a very different things that could happen, right? You have peacekeeping forces that are sent in specifically to serve as a kind of armed neutrality group. So let's say that you have two hostile camps that are trying to fight each other, right? They're trying to blow each other up. The UN at different times would send soldiers in that are from a mixed group of nations that would be standing in the middle of that conflict zone. And neither side could attack each other. Because if they did, they might accidentally hit the UN forces. And if you hit the UN forces, every single other nation that had sent allied contributed forces to it is now going to come in and bomb the hell out of you.
Not great.
Yes. So you could almost think of them as being like, they're not sacrificial pawns. That is not the right term at all. But they are there specifically as a deterrent that you don't want to risk accidentally hitting them.
A buffer. They're a buffer.
They are. Yes, that is actually a great way to describe it. Yes, they are effectively a buffer. So when the UN Emergency Forces were established in 1956 as the first peacekeeping force, soldiers from different nations were brought under one force, but at the time, they wore their own national uniforms. In order to be able to identify them as being part of the UN, distinctive armbands and shoulder patches were added, but they still needed something to make them more easily identifiable from a distance. And to remedy this issue, the UN Security General or Secretary General went and created the distinctive light blue beret and helmets. To ensure this distinctive color would provide the protection that it was meant to, international laws would then dictate that no national military or combatants could use light blue headgear. Which then makes you wonder, okay, have there been any specific instances where this has actually happened? And the answer is yes. Since the UN was created, there have actually been documented incidents of groups using distinctive UN blue on clothing and vehicles. Most recently, this actually happened in 2022. Kazakhstan soldiers were pictured wearing UN helmets while cracking down on anti-government protests, which resulted in a rebuke from the UN saying that the UN insignia is only to be used when performing mandated tasks as UN peacekeepers. So they were using this. I don't even know why they would necessarily do it. Perhaps it is something to give the impression that the entire world, not just the forces of Kazakhstan, were against these protesters, but the entire world was against them and that they were wrong, to kind of cement their authority. But no, that was a flagrant violation of their use. That was not supposed to be done. Unlike the previous example, though, blue headgear and the rest of what is covered in this episode, they're fair game in gaming and other media because it's not actual warfare. But you shouldn't mistake the use of the color light blue for using the UN logo. That's not the case. Just like in the case of the Red Cross, I'm very sure that the UN has a whole bunch of lawyers that are ready to go against you if you actually try to do that. The next one, though, is I wouldn't necessarily call it a weird one, but it is also one that is very commonly violated, arguably one of the most common war crimes that is violated in any case, because many people don't necessarily realize that it is actually a war crime.
Which one would that be?
Not taking any prisoners.
So killing everyone?
Yeah. Like you think, okay, well, you got to take prisoners, right?
No, I've never thought you have to take prisoners.
See, that's the thing. That's why people don't realize you do.
Why?
If someone surrenders to you, the moment that they surrender, they're a non-combatant.
But, okay, here's the thing. If you're in war and it's just you and I don't know, the other unit you're fighting, and they surrender, but no one's around to confirm that they surrendered, did they really surrender?
That's like if a tree like got chopped down in the middle of the woods, but no one heard it. Did it still get chopped down? Yes. Yes, it did.
I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I'm just saying it's only a war crime if someone snitches.
It's only a trialable war crime. And that's if you stole money from a bank, but no one found out. Did you commit a crime? Yes, you still did.
Okay, yeah, but not if no one snitched.
If you murdered someone and no one found out, did you still commit murder?
I'm just saying it's war. I'm pretty sure none of the soldiers who do it are going to be like, guess what we did?
That's why there's many cases. You're right.
Like, that's my whole point. My whole point is no one's going to go home and be like, oh no, guys, we did something really bad.
There were some that did, but others specifically would take things to the grave. Like, no, that is something that straight up would happen. Like, here's the thing. You are right. You are right. You absolutely are right. And there is that famous line that you oftentimes see in games and movies and comics and all different kinds of things. Take no prisoners. You know, like that's something that you hear that is commonly shouted. The reality is that if you declare that no quarter is to be given, that's a war crime on real battlefields.
What is no quarter?
Oh, I'm going to explain that here because it's actually a very fun little tidbit here. So you heard the term, give them no quarter, right?
Yeah, I hear it in games.
So, okay. You know what quarters are in like, okay, I say that. How many different things could I be referring to that as a quarter? Like
houses, a quarter, coins.
Yeah, that's what you typically think of, right? So the term for give no quarter, that goes back all the way to the case of like the English Civil War, in which, if I recall correctly, they basically were not going to, like, for anyone that was like Irish prisoners or anyone else like that, they weren't going to give them any housing or shelter. So give them no quarter was basically they have nothing. We are not going to protect them. We're not going to save them. They will die in the elements and deal with it. That's where I think that comes from.
Really?
Yeah. It's, listen, the way that the English treated the Irish was not great. All right. There's a lot of centuries of stuff that has happened there. It really has.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
What do you get when you take two childhood friends with a passion for unexplored history and a whole lot of booze?
You get the goofiest game in history, Queen's Podcast.
Hi, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Katie, and we're the hosts of Queen's Podcast.
Join us while we spill the tea on women from history.
We get into all kinds of stories here, like biographies of lesser-known figures, for instance, Sayida Halkura, powerful pirate queen.
To the stories you might already know, like Marie Antoinette or Cleopatra, but with a fun twist.
Each queen is paired with a cocktail that'll totally get you in the mood to hear fun, juicy, and dramatic stories from history.
Because history is so much more than just dudes on a battlefield, and we believe that the female perspective and roles are just as deserving of their time in the spotlight.
Right. So come get to know these queens. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Cheers.
Okay, so the whole thing about shouting, give them no quarter or anything like that, it is something that specifically goes back to the Hague Convention of 1907. And this is a rule that was violated by basically every single country that fought any kind of conflict within a decade of it being adopted. Infractions would range from violation of neutral territory to not taking prisoners. It was just awful. And the Fourth Hague Convention of the Laws and Customs of War on Land, Article 23, stated explicitly, among other things, that it is expressly forbidden to declare that no quarter be given. So yeah, the term no quarter originates back to the English Civil War of 1642, which would give birth to the 1644 Ordinance, which would insist that no quarter be given to the Irish. The ordinance ordered officers to quite literally refuse housing or otherwise shelter Irish soldiers that were fighting in England and Wales and Irish sailors at sea who surrendered. Today, the act of giving no quarter simply means to take no prisoners. And it is this specific declaration and action that has been made into a war crime. It is important to note that it's not just the act of giving no quarter, but specifically the audible command of give no quarter that is issued to troops or any kind of verbiage that would even imply that no prisoners are to be taken. Like, that is something that is a violation of the convention article.
I have a question. So let's say you're in a battle or some sort of war where you don't have a lot of rations, you don't have a lot of anything to go around. Like, you don't have MREs to feed prisoners. And then you took prisoners and they died. Is that a war crime?
War crime, yes.
But you can?
It's a catch 22. I am in full agreement. And that is something that did happen.
So yeah, because you can't tell people, oh, you have to take prisoners, but like you can barely feed yourself. So obviously you're not going to feed prisoners first. I mean, I would, but that's because I have no sense of self-preservation. But I'm assuming most soldiers probably would not.
No, and there were actually many cases, especially going back into World War II, right? The amount of times that this would happen with German, with Japanese, with Russians, etc., is that between those three powers, they arguably faced the greatest amount of supply issues going into the later parts of the war. And especially, between the Germans and the Soviets, no quarter was given regardless, because the Germans were actually trying to exterminate the Slavic peoples. Like, that wasn't a war to break the Soviet Union. That was a war that they wanted to exterminate all of the people within it to make living space for themselves.
Why? Okay, we don't have to get into that.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing.
But, wow.
So it was not a war of conquest. It was a war of extermination. And so the idea of no quarter being given in that in response, yeah, it makes total sense as to why that would happen. In other cases, like the Japanese were horribly brutal for their prisoner of war camps. Horrible. And they regularly would starve the prisoners specifically in order to just, well, conserve their supplies, even when they had plenty of supplies, just because they did not believe in actually providing anything for prisoners. That was a regular thing that would happen. And this would get worse and worse and worse as time would go on, and that things would become tighter and tighter and tighter for these forces that were losing the war. Like, it wasn't good. It absolutely was not good. Some of the most well-documented cases of these indirect orders to not take prisoners, this actually comes back from World War I. Remember how everyone, like, we've made shorts about it. We've made jokes about it. You've seen the comments that have talked about Canadians and like, oh, the Canadians and the Geneva Conventions. Do you mean the Geneva Suggestions?
Yeah, the Canadians I've heard were nuts.
Correct. Yeah, the Canadians back in World War I were insane. The Canadian Expeditionary Force was truly incredibly aggressive and it was strong. It was. There was a Canadian historian who published an article on surrender during World War I. And during his research, he found many different references in soldiers' journals where officers would suggest that prisoners were not to be taken, and later that very day would witness Canadian soldiers just factory resetting, surrendering Germans. They would do this. There is one of the a reason that this is actually commonly associated with Canadians, and also this was associated with Australians and New Zealanders. the different forces of the Commonwealth back during World War One.
Were they just used as fodder?
Sort of.
From the British?
Shock troops.
So fodder.
Kind of, in the World War One setting. The Canadian, these forces were generally regarded as being very aggressive. Like they wanted to prove their mettle to the Empire. So their forces were generally under their varying commanders and also the troops themselves. And this wasn't the British talking about them this way. This is how they specifically thought of themselves. They were very aggressive. The Canadians were famous for trench raiding. Like they would literally equip their soldiers with pickaxes, maces, knives, and send them sneaking over at night into the enemy trenches and just start hacking and stabbing people. They were very aggressive. The Canadians were famous for this.
Did they just want to be badass? They wanted the war to be over faster?
Yes. Also, the idea of trench night raids, it's psychological warfare on the enemy. You never know where they're going to come. And that is a horrible, horrible ending. I want you, if you would look up anything, look up trench raider weapons. Look it up right now on your phone. And you're going to see some examples of this, of where they would literally, what is the right term? Throw weapons together.
Is Battlefield 1 the one where you have to go into the trenches?
Yes.
And there's all the gas? And every single time I do it, I'd start screaming?
Yes. Yeah, you are entirely right. Yeah, it's Battlefield 1 of those games.
Those are terrifying games, especially when the gas would start going everywhere and then I start panicking. Oh, man. Anyway, but I just looked up the trench raider weapons and they do not look pleasant. They look very unpleasant, very sharp. Don't recommend it. If you could avoid that, is that a gun with a knife on it?
Yep.
And also, okay, so it is a gun with a knife on it and knuckle rings.
Yep.
That can't be real, right?
Yeah, no, there were many different examples where they would literally custom build their own trench raider weapons. They would. One of the most common ones that they would take is like a, they would literally just take like a club. They would make a club and then just put spikes in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of clubs with spikes on the end and then the other end is pointed. So dual weapon, you could dual wield it, you know, stab and blunt force trauma if you so needed.
Yep.
All around bad time.
There
my
personal favorite among all those were punch gauntlets.
There's a lot of, what are those things? Harlequin had one, well, not a bat, but like the bat with the spikes in it. What are those called?
Oh, you a mace?
Like is that
a flanged mace?
Yeah. There's a lot of different types of maces. So many. And then there's this thing that looks like a hammer, but then they just put a really big spike in the end.
Yeah.
They use those on people?
Yes, they would use that on people. Again, Geb, look up a punch gauntlet. Like literally just look up punch gauntlet, World War One, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Like, trust me on this. It is something. It's my personal favorite among all those different weapons because it may not have had the reach, but holy shit was that idea of it terrifying.
Is it just a glove with a spike on it?
It is literally a glove with a spike on it.
So did they just, nope.
So think about this. Someone else perhaps has a bladed weapon that they're going to try to swing at you. You have an armored gauntlet on your hand that you use to block. And then on the end of that gauntlet is a long spike that you proceed to push past and then punch into their body. Yeah, the face that you're making right now, that's how they probably felt too when their guts were being rearranged by the spike.
That saying does not mean what you think it means.
I know what it means. And in this case, it was being rearranged and then separated from their bodies.
Ew. Okay, guys, all around in general, consensus is trench raiding weapons, horrifying. Also, I'd imagine the soldiers in the trenches would be so afraid of being raided, they won't sleep. So
literally, yes, that was the point.
You would be completely messed up because if it freaked me out in video games, I could not imagine someone doing it in real life because you're just in the trench and some guy jumps over. Oh, man. Nope.
Yep. The Canadians were famous for this. They were specifically famous for being incredibly aggressive nighttime like raiders. They did this a lot. Okay. Moving on from that, though, nature and the environment. Something that you also probably don't expect from the Geneva Conventions is that there are now varying different protections in place for the natural environment. And if you know anything about the United States and Vietnam, you can probably already taste the Agent Orange. Remember how we talked about this before? There have been many different things, and this is something that I always try to explain to people online, but people don't want to listen. You get a lot of people who talk about that everything the United States did, like the United States was not justified in Vietnam. Oh, the United States was committing war crimes in Vietnam. Oh, they absolutely did. Don't get me wrong. They absolutely did. But Agent Orange is one of those things that is commonly cited as being a war crime. It was not. It was not. But specifically because of the United States and Agent Orange, it became a war crime. Remember that expression, it's never a war crime the first time?
Yes.
The United States was the first time here. That's exactly what was going on here. So let's kind of break this down here for a second. Some of the protections are with the specific intent of preventing long-term harm to the environment within the Geneva Conventions, and others are protecting food sources. Like, as an example, if we are talking about like Protocol 1, Article 54, it is against this to destroy the food sources of civilians with the intent of inflicting hardship directly on said civilian population. This includes targeting livestock, crops, and the materials and means to grow crops. Mind you, when we're talking about burning crops or taking any of that stuff down, that is a tactic that has literally been used for thousands of years. It is perhaps the oldest tactic in the book when fighting an enemy. It really is. You want to destroy their ability to wage war. And the first way that you do that is go after their food. It really is. The two most famous examples of this are like in the case of Russia using a scorched earth tactics like approach to slow the advance of the French in the Napoleonic Wars, as well as doing the same kind of thing later on as the Soviet Union against the Germans during Operation Barbarossa back in World War II. The other example of this that would also constitute, though again, it did not exist at the time, was the U.S. slaughtering of the buffalo population in order to try and subdue and destroy the different native groups during the Manifest Destiny period. Like, I kid you not, there are many scenes of when the United States was connecting everything by railroad, right? And as passengers were riding the rails heading to the West, they would pass by these herds of buffalo, and you would just have passengers pointing guns outside of the train as it is moving and shooting buffalo. Not harvesting them, not hunting them, not just literally just wiping them out. Doing it for sport, but not even for sport. Just to wipe them out.
Really?
The United States specifically tried to wipe out the buffalo to reduce its population because the natives of the plains specifically depended upon the buffalo for everything. It was clothing. It was food. It was shelter. It was fire. Like the dung specifically to use for fire. It was everything. So you reduce the buffalo population. You reduce the ability of the native of like the plain natives to exist. At the time, not a war crime. It would be if it was done today. But at that time, that was a tactic that has been used by different peoples for centuries, thousands of years even.
Throughout history, royals across the world were notorious for incest. They married their own relatives in order to consolidate power and keep their blood blue. But they were oblivious to the havoc all this inbreeding was having on the health of their offspring. From Egyptian pharaohs marrying their own sisters to the Habsburgs' notoriously oversized lower jaws. I explore the most shocking incestuous relationships and tragically inbred individuals in royal history. And that's just episode one. On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ plus royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history. Join me every Tuesday for new episodes of the History Tea Time podcast, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So, okay, the most interesting protocol, though, of all of these is Protocol 1, Article 55. Which declares that care must be taken to protect the environment from widespread, long-term, and severe damage. This prohibits methods of warfare that are either intended to or may be expected to cause damage, which would or otherwise be suspected to cause health issues or jeopardize the survival of the population. It also protects nations from international targeting of the environment as an act of reprisal by an agitator.
Okay, so if you affect the environment in a way that negatively affects the population, it's a war crime?
Yes. Like, let's say that you launched a dirty bomb into a water source to spread nuclear radiation to screw with their water. War crime.
Interesting.
Like, and you may wonder then, okay, well, what could possibly cause this to become a thing that would be included? Well, Protocol 1, article, like, this whole thing was adopted in 1977. Which was just after the Vietnam War, where the U.S. would use a multitude of weapons that were specifically intended to, as the protocol states, cause widespread, long-term, severe damage, as well as adverse effects to the local population. Most notable to this was Agent Orange. Interestingly enough, and many people think that Agent Orange was developed as like a weapon of war to use against the Vietnamese. No.
Wasn't it just to clear the landscape, like to clear the trees so they can see?
It was literally an herbicide that was already being used in the United States.
And they just wanted to clear the thick growth so they can get through it.
Correct. Because the Vietnamese, like the Viet Cong in here, they were specifically ambushing anywhere and everywhere. They knew the jungles. They would use the jungles for hiding. They would attack, they would melt back into the forest. Like, you couldn't do anything really against them.
So if it was being used in the U.S., they had no side effects at that time within the U.S. where it was being used first?
Not for anything for studies that would have proven otherwise. And at the same time, it wouldn't have been used on such a widespread scale. There is a difference of like applying some Agent Orange in order to be able to kill off some weeds versus we're going to try to kill an entire forest.
Because I know a lot of even the soldiers got really sick, like the U.S. soldiers well. So they did a number on so many people and changed so many people's lives for the worst.
Oh, it did. It absolutely did. To this very day, the after effects of Agent Orange continues to result in all different kinds of health issues. For Vietnam veterans, this is something where you see people who have a significant higher cancer rate than other people's. And that's just for the Vietnam veterans. The same thing easily applies to the people of Vietnam. To this day, birth defects, sterility, numerous forms of cancers, all different kinds of things are significantly more common in the Vietnamese countryside and wooded territories than otherwise would exist. Like, there are entire foundations that exist specifically in order to try and help the Vietnamese with birth defects because they have a higher rate of it than most other places, specifically because of Agent Orange. It's insane. And it if anyone goes out there and looks up any images of it, Kevin, please, I'm telling you, don't do it. They are actually horrifying to look at for what happens.
That's really sad.
It is. It really is. The final thing that we're going to be talking about is something that's a little bit more theoretical, though. The use of historic monuments. And mind you, this is entirely a technicality, but it is an entertaining thought and a much lighter note to actually end things on here with this. So one article of the Geneva Convention, Protocol 1, Article 53, the protection of cultural objects and places of worship. This is an article that prohibits A, the acts of hostility directed at historic monuments, works of art, or places of worship which constitute the cultural or spiritual heritage of peoples. B, to use such objects in support of the military effort, and C, to make such objects the object of reprisal. The section that makes this entire thing so interesting is Section B. The article is supposed to prevent places of worship and cultural sites from being used by any military or made into targets by any military. But the thing is, this article, in theory, can include museums and historic sites, and by extension, cover anything that exists within those sites. So if we look at Article B, it could be interpreted in two different ways. The first is that any weapons that are there within these sites cannot be used in support of the military effort, implying that if you are, say, a soldier and you find yourself in a museum, and let's say you go and just pick up a sword that is in there that is on display and you go and use that sword as a weapon to kill someone, technically speaking, you committed a war crime because you just used a cultural artifact as a weapon of war. That is something. The second interpretation is that no historic sites or monuments may be used as a weapon. And you may be wondering then at that point, how is it possible for a historic monument to be used as a weapon? Well, the answer is pretty simple, actually.
Are they like tanks and other types of machinery?
Oh, there is. But we're talking about the entire building itself. You can't move a museum now, can you, right?
No.
Well, you can if something has been turned into a museum.
So like a ship.
There you go. Do you remember the movie? What was it? 2012, 2013? Do you remember the Battleship movie where they go and fight aliens with a freaking battleship?
I wish I knew what you were talking about.
You never saw... Gabby, Rihanna was in that movie. Like she plays one of the...
I think... Oh, a Tiger Cruise?
It was so good. It was so stupid, but so good.
Was Tiger Cruise the one where all the kids were on the like battleship when 9/11 happened?
Oh God.
I don't remember the name of it.
I think that was.
That's the only battleship movie I've ever watched. Well, that and like Pearl Harbor, but that wasn't a battleship movie.
We're going to watch this movie together and you're going to see what I'm talking about because it's amazing. It's stupid, but it's so good. So the battleship we're talking about here is the USS Missouri, right? So let's say that this thing gets used as a weapon again, right? The reason I say that is because the USS Missouri is currently a floating museum. Like, that's what it is. Like, you can go... Remember how we went onto that one battleship before when we were in Norfolk?
The USS Wisconsin?
Yes. Yes. The USS Wisconsin. Old Temper, which is... Oh, my God. It's still such a funny story. Hear from that. Yeah, so the whole thing with the Missouri is that in the movie Battleship, they literally take this thing that was a museum and a bunch of World War II vets come back and serve on it again when the Earth is under attack by aliens. And the only thing that was available that could be used is the frickin' battleship. So they take it out to sea and they frickin' fight the alien mothership with this old World War II battleship.
That sounds like something you dreamed, babe.
Oh my God, I know.
To believe that's a real thing.
It is. It's amazing. And we're going to watch it together because I love that movie, even though it's so bad. So yeah, if that happened, you know, technically speaking, in this movie, the use of the Missouri, which was a museum because it was recommissioned then, I guess, as a tool of war, that means that technically that action in the movie was a war crime. Yeah. Of course, you know, they were fighting aliens, so maybe that whole thing kind of removes the authority of the Geneva Conventions or other international law to actually oversee it, but you know, who really actually knows? That ruins the fun of the whole hypothetical in the first place. Either way, that is the end of what it is that we were talking about today. But actually, no, I realize there's one more before we go. That whole thing about museums and pulling off for things for weapons of war. Have you seen the video of what happened with some of the jerry-rigged weapons in Syria?
No.
A technical vehicle is when you have like a truck or something that has a weapon that has been mounted onto the back of it. And usually in this case, it's like a 50 cal machine gun or something like that.
So the Toyota Hilux with all the big guns.
Yes. In Syria, in the civil war, there are pictures and video, I think I recall correctly, of some guys who mounted like a 17th century cannon to the back of one of these trucks. And they jerry-rigged it to be able to fire improvised mortar shells. The only way that they could have gotten that is by stealing it from a museum. which means that I don't know who these guys are. But if they did that, technically speaking, that's probably a war crime.
But they're private citizens.
But we already covered what happens. And guess what? They're fighting. They're combatants.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So note to self, don't steal museum weapons in World War III.
I don't think if an actual World War III breaks out that that's really going to matter at that point, because it seems that every time there's a world war of some kind, the Geneva Conventions become more of the suggestions.
Yeah, everybody kind of forgets. I love how they're a big deal in times of peace, and then the moment a war breaks out, everyone's like, okay, about the rules, screw the rules.
Yeah.
And they just do whatever. Because again, how are you taking people, as we talked in the last episode, how would you actually punish anyone, you know?
Again, they'd usually what ends up happening is that people get punished after. The loser does, at least.
Wow.
Anyway, my friends, that, I think, is going to be the end of things here today.
Goodbye. And remember, all's fair in love and war.
Oh my, that is not what we want to end this on when talking about war crimes, Gabby.
I was trying to leave them with a good message, babe.
Goodbye, everyone.